It's Andy Parks live from the Washington Times on 7:30 a.m., 102.9 FM, WTNT, and I'm joined now by Chris Versace. Chris writes The Corner of Wall and Main here at the Washington Times. His column today, Fastballs Getting Past Fed Europeans. Now, before I get into that,
sure.
You got to help me out on all these numbers we're hearing about today.
Oh, you mean the big July unemployment or employment rate that the Bureau of Labor Statistics so nicely furnished?
Yeah. I have never heard a more confusing approach to numbers than I've heard coming out of CNN and Fox and MSNBC, you name the network.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's got a different take on this, and a lot of it has to do with your political leaning. Please, try to cut through all the minutia and tell us what really happened.
Sure. So let's go with the facts, okay?
All right.
What do we know? We know that 163,000 jobs were added in July, far stronger than anybody had been expecting.
Okay.
The census numbers were around 100 to 110,000 jobs for the month. So I think what we're seeing is a big sigh of relief, because the number was stronger than expected, and two, it kind of reverses the trend of what we saw in the second quarter. And just as a reminder, in 2Q, new jobs created in the month, each month, averaged about 75,000 jobs, which was horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
But now let's get some understanding now that we know what the facts are. Yes, the number was better than expected, but still far slower than we saw in the first quarter. In the first quarter, new jobs averaged about 225,000 per month added,
mm-hmm.
So far stronger. So, you know, a little bit better, but still weaker than what we had. And if we look at the year-to-date number, it's still only about 150,000, 155,000, which really means we're not moving the needle.
Okay. All right.
Now the bad news.
All right.
The bad news would be that the unemployment rate actually went up because more people are looking for jobs, and they're not getting them. At the same time, the labor participation rate fell just a bit, and as a result, about 348,000 Americans are now out of the workforce compared to June. So it says to me that more people are dropping out than are actually finding jobs. Not a good thing.
All right, well, let me ask you, how did they come up with that number of close to 350,000 people dropping out? I'm just curious as to the methodology.
Well, there's a number of adjustments that they go through, and remember, this is a survey. So it really, everything hinges on the pool of people that you're surveying,
uh-huh.
Dumping it in, and, you know, kind of doing some funky things with it. And by funky things, I mean a number of adjustments that they make based on historically what has happened. So, for example, historically, manufacturing plants, like, you know, construction equipment companies, ag equipment companies, automotive companies, you know, Ford, GM, they tend to have summer shutdowns. So they massage the numbers a little bit to account for that. You know, and they do various other things. So, to me, sometimes the headline is often a little misleading. We'll have to look forward to see, A, what the revisions say, but I will tell you this. The BLS numbers that came out today are in conflict with Intuit, Gallup, and others reported. All of them had far weaker job creation in July.
Hmm. All right, you'll be happy to know I've just been handed a press release from the White House that says the actual unemployment number today is 8.254%, not 8.3%.
Wow, that really moves the needle, huh? The fact of the matter, it's been over 8% for, you know, some ridiculous amount of time.
Yeah.
And no matter how much, you know, sugar-coated stimulus we throw at it, cash for clunkers, whatever,
right.
We haven't gotten, you know, through to it. And that was part of the commentary in my column today, which is that if we take a look at, you know, the Fed not acting this week, the ECB not acting this week, you know, we're still in limbo as to when we might get another round of stimulus if we do. The bottom line is we can make money as cheap as we want, but unless we fix the issue of underlying demand, we fix the issue of tax uncertainty, the issue of cost uncertainty, it's going to be very difficult for people to spend and businesses to go out and expand and hire. Plain and simple.
Okay. Now, I want you to kind of go through a little bit of what you just touched on, and that was the thought, and again, this is me trying to translate, you know, some stuff that I'm really not 100% on, okay? It appeared that the European Central Bank, the ECB you mentioned, was going to buy up debt or invest in governments and thereby prop them up and putting some faith back into those institutions. Is that what I got from that?
That's pretty much what it is. You know, Mario Draghi, who's the president of the ECB, pretty much said last week, hey, I'm going to do whatever it takes to save the euro.
Okay, and so, I remember that.
Right, so everybody got really hopped up.
Gotcha.
Because they knew the ECB was meeting this week.
Right.
So when they didn't do anything, it was kind of a, yeah, the baseball term, a whiff.
Yeah. Right,
where you expect to hit, nothing happens.
Right.
Same time this week, the Federal Reserve met Tuesday, Wednesday, and as usual, when they come out of these meetings, they make some policy announcement. They, too, said, well, we're going to wait a little while longer. And on the one hand, I actually think that's a good thing. And I say that because the next meeting or opportunity they have to do something is around September 12th or 13th.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what I suspect the Fed is trying to do is not goose the economy in advance of the election. In other words, trying to sway the election potentially.
Right.
And I think that's a good thing. And the reality is if they do something September 12th or 13th, it really won't show up in the data until almost, you know, late October, early November. So the odds of it really swaying the election will be very minimal, I think.
Okay. All right. I want to move on to a couple other things. You had some columns for Forbes, and mm-hmm. one caught my eye, and that's Amazon Video puts Netflix in the crosshairs. How so?
Well, you know, Netflix is, you know, they're the online DVD rental and streaming service.
Right.
And we're seeing a lot of players that have been in this space for streaming double down. Amazon is kind of one of them. You know, they've had, as everybody knows, the ability to buy things online, but they've been quietly putting together a number of different services that are challenging other players, most notably Netflix, because now you can go to your iPad, your PC, your smartphone, whatever you want to do, and start streaming video through Amazon. And Amazon has a much richer selection of content than Netflix does.
Yeah.
And you have to remember, Netflix lost an agreement with Starz that had a lot of more current streaming programming, movies, mm-hmm. TV shows, and the like. So with that, they're kind of at a competitive disadvantage. But you've got Apple, you've got Google, and others that are, you know, pushing into this. And it's just the latest nail, if you will, in what could be Netflix's coffin.
And their stock prices have dropped dramatically, right?
Well, exactly. And, you know, they've talked about slowing subscriber growth, which is not a reason to own a stock.
Yeah.
The competitive landscape is tightening. And when you all offer the same thing, right, movies or TV shows, you know, what are you going to compete on? Price. And we've seen this before in computers, cars, airlines. When all you can compete on is price, that is not a business model to invest in.
Mm-hmm. All right. One of the other columns I saw that you evidently just posted, and I really haven't had a lot of time to get into it, but
sure.
the title is Falling Trading Volume Takes Its Toll. Can you explain that?
Sure. So when we look at the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, they report monthly trading volumes. And that's an indicator of how some broker-dealers and investment banks garner their revenue stream, right? So the more they trade, the more transaction costs they get. So the flip is true. If people are not trading or trading volumes are falling, the transaction costs are going to slide. Just like if you were to go to, you know, MasterCard or Visa, the more you pay with your card, the more money they're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing is true for these firms. M&A activity was very slow. That's a very lucrative business for these companies. So when we put the 1-2 together, you know, the smaller and mid-tier investment do things are going to be very tight on revenue. So people should just, you know, take a look at what's going on in the NYSE and the NASDAQ and avoid these smaller brokerage houses. That's the message.
Okay. Very good. Man, you've answered a lot of questions today. I appreciate it, as always. Folks, if you need to get in touch with Chris, it's chrisversace.com. That's V-E-R-S-A-C-E. And if you get the chance, check out Corner of Wall and Main in the Washington Times. Fastballs getting past Fed and Europeans. Thank you, sir. Have a good weekend.
You too, Andy. Thank you.